following program was recorded in Angel Fire, New Mexico in September 2010. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Angel Fire in New Mexico. And we have Chris O'Brien, and a very interesting man. Chris, welcome to the show. And first of all, you do wonderful things. You're working with a lot of people. I know you're doing some stuff on the Paracast. You're working with
Ray Stanford.
Yeah, that we've done shows with, and we still have another show to do with him that we've recorded. He's quite an interesting individual.
Oh, yeah. They broke the mold when Ray came along, and his twin brother, Rex.
And on top of all that, you've got a great story to tell, and let's talk about what's happening up here in Colorado.
Well, just in a nutshell, of course, I've been a long-time investigator of the things that go bump in the night, and I started in 1992 as very innocently as a reporter for my local newspaper, little town paper, and we had some incredible UFO sightings that quite a number of people, about 15, I think, witnesses saw. And I thought, hey, this sounds great. I thought all the UFO sightings in the San Luis Valley ended back in the 60s, maybe the 70s. I didn't think anything was still going on, so I got excited, and I interviewed everybody and was going to write a little article for my local newspaper, which ended up being a large article. And within 2 months, I was on national TV, and I've just never looked back since. I've amassed a huge database of unusual events that have occurred in the San Luis Valley, Colorado, which is just north here of the Taos area. It's a big valley. It's the largest alpine valley in the world. It extends all the way up, into Colorado. And I'm down here speaking about my work in the San Luis Valley.
Well, let's talk about what's going on up there. I mean, things still happening, I
think. Oh, yeah. I just had a woman come down and introduce herself, and she lives just over the border and, with New Mexico. She's just over the border in Colorado. And 4 days ago, she had a big black triangular-shaped object with a weird apparatus on the back end fly right over her ranch. And then I think a week and a half, about 10 days ago, she had sighting of F-16s chasing this brilliant orange globe across the valley. And so things are still going on. Since November of 2009, we've had 12 mutilated cattle, 2 mutilated horses, and a mutilated goat. So things are definitely picking up. The last couple of years, we've seen things really pick up. From about 1999 to 2005, there was very little activity. We had a brief upsurge for about 6 months, and then it stopped. There was complete cessation of activity, and then in the last 2 years, it's really started to take off again.
So these cattle mutilations, and we talk about that, but you just mentioned other animals involved.
Yeah.
Have you run across any human
mutilations? Well, interesting you should ask. I just, about a half hour ago, I had a gentleman come up and say that he had heard some scuttlebutt on shortwave radio that there were 3 teenagers that were found mutilated in the San Luis Valley about the end of April, he thinks. Now, I normally wouldn't, since you asked.
I understand.
I normally would not say anything about that. Again, I don't want to ID the spot where this supposedly occurred. I need to call the sheriff of that particular county and do some investigative work and some research on this.
Well, we'll certainly follow
up. I would be very disturbed if this proved out to be true. That's horrific to think about.
Now, what do you think's happening with what's going on? Or is it various things?
Yeah, it's very complicated. I really have a sense that there are multiple groups with multiple agendas. I think a vast majority of true cases. First of all, let me kind of qualify this. I think quite a number of these reported cases are amateur people looking at something that appears high strange and ascribing high strangeness to it. I think a lot of these cases are misidentified scavenger and predator action. But there are quite a number that aren't. And I've personally investigated over 200 cases, and I've seen some that just are physically impossible to explain. Unfortunately, we don't have the time. We have time windows that we can investigate these things scientifically. The Valley tends not to produce these cases, the next morning. It's very rare to have a case that happened the night before. Usually there's been a day or two or three. And we have to be there in a timely manner to get forensic samples so that veterinary pathologists and diagnostic labs can do our testing for us. But I have a sense that there's a human agency that's potentially monitoring the spread of mad cow disease in the food chain. I don't think it's the ranch, it's the animal. I think it's a location where these cases occur. The San Luis Valley has no pollution, and so this may be like a control group for their baseline data, and then they're maybe doing cases elsewhere, South America, Australia, and looking for the spread of transmissible spongiform encephalopathy in the food chain. Yes, I still eat beef, but I'm very careful about what beef I eat. Let's put it that way.
Right. So you figure this is some sort of a U.S. government activity, or do you figure CETA activity, or do you? What do you think?
I don't
it is?
Really factor anything totally out or anything totally in.
Okay.
We've had some high strange cases that I don't think that modern science could even duplicate. There have been some very bizarre cases. One case I had where the animal's brain was missing with no break into the cranium, no evidence at all in a pristine snowfield. The animal was totally drained of fluids, which is rare. Most of these animals aren't drained of fluids, but contrary to popular belief. But this particular one was, and it wouldn't rot. There was a total retardation of the necrotic process, which was very disturbing. It had a kind of a weird sort of perfumey medicine smell.
Was this a cow or what?
It was a calf, a yearling calf, and it was missing all its respiratory organs. Its upper respiratory organs were gone, the lungs and the heart. And I had a case back in the late 90s where the animal's spinal cord was excised with no break in the spine. How do you do that? How do you ream out perfectly a spinal cord? There have been some cases that have been bizarre. There was a case in the late 70s in Weld County, Colorado, where when they went to do an autopsy on the animal, and they cut into the animal, there was a female cow, and they cut into the bag, the udder, where the udders are. It was perfectly packed with sand. Sand, yeah. So that when you looked at it, it looked like it was just a regular bag filled with milk. But uh-huh. then when you cut into it, it was filled with sand. How do you explain that? I mean, there's been.
And now it was. How do you think the sand got in there?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That wasn't your tax dollars at work. That was something definitely different.
Uh-huh.
We've had cases of unborn fetuses that have been found during an autopsy that have been mutilated in the same fashion as the mother. How do you explain that? So these are very rare cases. The vast majority of cases tend to be done with sharp implements like a scalpel. They tend to be a little bit less professional looking than some of the high strange cases. It's really very complicated terrain. This is it's not a cut and dried one size fits all explanation for it.
We'll follow up with a little bit more about that, but we want to talk about Chris for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You have a website?
I do indeed. OurStrangePlanet.com. That's OUR Strange Planet.
Have a link to that.
Yeah. It's.
Will you find on there?
Well, if you become a member of the site, which is free, and we don't give away email addresses or anything or spam you or anything, but that will allow you to get in and have access to my entire database. I'm open source with all my data. I don't hold anything back. I don't charge for it. So if you're interested in my work, my sighting log goes all the way back to 1777, which was the first documented sighting in the San Luis Valley. So it's all there. Plus, I update it with strange stories and unusual events and updates from the world of the paranormal. It's chock full of stuff.
Have you written a book?
I've written 5 books, actually.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I've written a bunch.
That was a leading question.
I've written 3 books about my San Luis. I've written 3 books about my San Luis Valley investigative work. I call it the Mysterious Valley Trilogy. I've just written a book that came out about a year ago called Stalking the Tricksters, which is an out-of-the-box attempt to come up with a unified field theory to explain paranormal phenomenon. Go figure.
Interesting book.
Oh, yeah, it is.
A different concept.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to cover much of that material today because they're only giving me an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, my minimum talk is 2 hours, and I was going to try to do 2 talks in 1, but forget that. And I've also written an unpublished book on the life and times of Ray Stanford. which...
Oh, okay. Already, that explains why you're working with her.
Well, one of the reasons, yeah. I've already turned down a publishing deal on it because Ray doesn't want it out yet, so...
Well, we all know Ray.
Yeah.
He's an interesting fellow.
And, but he's a tough one.
And we have several interviews with him that people can find on our website, as far as that goes.
He's a fascinating guy. Talk about a guy who's been there and done that. There's very few people still in this field that can put sentences together that have been in the field over 50 years. He's one of them.
That's true. Now, you were working as a reporter.
Correct.
Covering regular stuff.
Regular stuff.
And what actually happened to get you there? I mean, just a sighting, or was...
Well, it was, yeah, I had a Christmas, New Year's Eve party in 1992, New Year's Eve, and about 30 people in my house, and everywhere I went in the party at one point, there were little groups of people talking about these UFOs that they'd seen, and nobody from the other rooms knew the other people had seen them, and I realized going to three or four different groups talking about the same sighting, I interviewed them all separately and brought them together and said, did you know all these people saw what you saw? And I wrote that first article, and I've done 40 TV shows and been on hundreds of radio shows.
How was the reaction there at the newspaper on the first article?
Well, they were a little leery. The little town, Crestone, where I lived, it has a reputation of being like a little mini Sedona wannabe. There's a lot of New Agers and stuff there, and it's a very metaphysical town, and some of this stuff does have the veneer of fear-based stuff, which I try to stay away from being judgmental, either positive or negative, about this stuff. Mutilated livestock doesn't seem very positive, but we mutilate a million head of livestock, every week and a half in this country. So,
You can't ignore it.
Yeah, you can't ignore it. So, we all love beef, most of us, and there was some initial enthusiasm, but as soon as the tourists started coming in, and I'd have van loads of Japanese tourists hop out and take pictures of my house, and it started to get a little weird there after a while. And I finally did end up leaving the valley in 2002 because I was becoming the story, and I felt that the actual work was suffering.
We don't expect you to reveal where you live now, or there.
Well, I'm south of Sedona. Let's put it that way.
So, okay. Now, you'd call this a mysterious valley, and we talked about UFO sightings, and we talked about animal mutilations. But as far as the rest of it, what else is mysterious happening there?
Oh, Jerry, you name it. The
you
variety.
Have a burning bush or something?
I've had a burning bush. Actually, Bill Moyers was a witness to it. He was walking with a Ute elder and Maurice Strong, who's Undersecretary General for the Environment of the UN. They're walking around a ghost town out in the Sangres, and a bush exploded into fire in front of them. Actually, it's funny you should ask. We've had witches, elementals, dwarves, leprechauns.
Wait a minute. Let's talk about the leprechauns. Yeah. I thought they were all in Ireland.
No. There's legends of dwarf forms and leprechaun forms. There's diminutive, elementals like sprite types. All the Native Americans in this part of the world and everywhere in the United States have traditions.
Any skinwalker legends up there?
Well, skinwalkers are black magicians in the Diné tradition, Apache and Navajo. I've had reports of skinwalkers. They're not the type of thing that you want to mess with. They're very powerful. They have hidden knowledge that they've been able to hold on to secretly for thousands of years.
So it seems to me, Chris, you're walking a fine line here, and I can identify with this myself. You're open to all of these things. Mm-hmm. But you're also, I guess, agnostic.
Yeah, I don't believe any of this. I don't believe any of this, but I am open-minded enough and intrigued enough to do the research.
That's what I'm trying to get at, because I've talked to you.
I don't even believe my own experiences half the time. I've seen stuff that it just I still can't believe.
Like what?
Every type of UFO that you could imagine. I've had them fly 150 feet in front of my car in broad daylight, structured craft, 12, 15 feet long. I've had huge triangles block out a sizable portion of the sky. I've seen stuff taken off, landing. I've run up on my porch and videotaped stuff flying by. I've videotaped as many as 13 UFOs in a single event with night vision. It just goes on and on. I have a network of sky watchers around the entire region, and And we have a phone tree. When things are really hopping, you know, we call each other and let each other know, hey, it's coming in your direction, that sort of thing. There's treasure legends here, the Native American legends, dimensional doorways, flying seed pods, star people. It just runs the gamut.
The flying teapot, tell me about that. It jumps off the table or what?
Flying seed pod.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's how they described it. I haven't looked at it. I haven't seen a flying teapot since I watched Alice in Wonderland. I think there was a flying teapot.
What we're talking about. Those say the poltergeist actions do happen, though.
Yeah, oh yeah. I had a really interesting couple of haunting cases.
About it, but actually,
there's been some pretty good haunting cases. I had a case last year, a year ago, June, where a new arrival to the valley was resting in his living room in his easy chair, and this he described it as like a giant copy machine light, you know, the vertical light that goes sideways and then back. It appeared above him in the vaulted ceiling, and he felt frozen in his chair, and his chair moved over to the other side of the room, and it freaked him out. He didn't know where to go, who to talk to. He found out about one of my field investigators, reported it to him, and it just unleashed a whole investigation. I had a report a couple of months ago. A couple from Italy was visiting Crestone. They were staying in a guest house, and they had this huge, brilliant ball of light circle the guest house right outside their windows. Totally freaked them out. And about 25 minutes later, a similar event occurred down at the Great Sand Dunes Oasis about 15, 20 miles away. So stuff's still going on there. And it's, I wouldn't know really where to begin. The variety and intensity of unusual occurrences. I've never heard of a place that has so many different types of things that happen so often.
I wonder why that location. Nobody really knows.
I have a theory. I think it's a portal area or a hotspot window area. It has unusual geophysical properties. There's unusual gravitational lows there. You have the Earth's magnetic field has minimum and maximum field strength in close proximity to one another. The seams between these areas tend to be where the activity occurs. We've got Native American legends that go back into prehistory. A documented historical record of waves of unusual events, and we have the military being up to its eye teeth in involvement in these areas. We have exotic craft, psychotronic conventional craft that are lit up to look like UFOs. We have UFOs that are being followed or chased by conventional military craft. I mean, it's a cauldron of, it's a kaleidoscope of activity.
Any known military bases around there?
Yeah, you got... About 15 minutes away, flight time is Buckley, Peterson, Lowry, NORAD, Cheyenne Mountain. So about a half hour away is Kirtland, Los Alamos.
So you have reason to believe the U.S. government's up to some of this.
Oh, absolutely. They may test all their stuff and get it operational in Area 51, but when they want to see how it affects the local population, they want to gauge the reaction, see if people spot it, if they report it as a UFO, if they file a report with the sheriff, if it makes the media, if there's some sort of spin on it. They want to gauge the psychological effect of this technology on an unsuspecting public. Area 52 would be a good way to describe the San Luis Valley, because I'm pretty convinced that they test certain exotic and even conventional aerial platforms there. Mm-hmm. And there's convoys of vehicles going around all the time. We have tunneling equipment seen moving through the valley. It's really a kaleidoscope there. I that's the only way I can describe it.
A couple of things come to mind when I'm talking to you about this. And the first thing, before I forget it, is you live there and you're working as a reporter. Were you aware of all this stuff going on before you got turned on and started investigating
No,
this?
I wasn't. I knew about the Snippy the Horse case. In fact,
tell me about that. I don't know.
Well, the Snippy the Horse case was the first publicized animal mutilation that occurred the end of the first week of September 1967. It was an international news story. I saw the National Enquirer, the World News, whatever rag at the grocery store when I was a 10-year-old kid. And I bugged my mom for a dime or however much it cost to buy it, because the headline was Flying Saucers Killed My Horse.
Yeah.
And they're looking at this horse that was totally denuded of all flesh from its shoulders to the tip of its nose. a very unusual case. And so I devoured the article before we even got home. And so that's when I first found out about the Valley. But I knew there was stuff going on there.
But not as intensely as...
Well, I thought it all ended back in the 70s. They had a wave of activity in the mid-70s that I'd heard about. But when I got there, I thought it was all ancient history. I just love the place because it's a very sacred, special... it's just a very powerful place. The quality of silence in the San Luis Valley is unlike anywhere I've been. There's a roaring silence. It's a very powerful place. The first day I moved there, I remember driving into town, looking up at the mountains, going, "What am I doing here? This place is carnivorous. It can eat you, chew you up and spit you out if you're not careful." And boy, I must be psychic.
The mysterious valley. Yeah. You got the ambiance or the vibrations or whatever when you moved there.
Right? Oh yeah, I started initially the first 2 years I was there. I would ask some of the locals, "Hey, you ever see anything something weird or see something weird?" And you go, "Yeah, I'm looking at one right now. Why are you asking me this?"
Yeah, I
quickly found out that asking questions about UFOs and mutilated livestock was not going to win me very many friends. So I kept my mouth shut and my ears open, put it that way.
We only got a couple more minutes with you, Chris, and then we have to move on. The website, tell me more about that. First of all, how they find it. We have a link to it, but a lot of people listen away from computers.
Right, ourstrangeplanet.com. Basically, it's a place to go to find out what's been going on the last few days. I try to keep it adding news stories there from around the world of strange events that don't make sense that occur daily around the planet. And then I also have a whole section about my San Luis Valley investigative work. And like I said before, my entire database is there. So you can spend a couple of weeks. It'll probably take you to read the whole thing. It's pretty voluminous. It's amazing. If I hadn't investigated and researched all the reports, I would have a hard time believing it.
Okay, you're doing some work for Ray Stanford. Mm-hmm. And also you do the Paracast. Mm-hmm. And what else is on your plate?
Well, I'm putting together a 7-8 camera surveillance setup on cell towers and mountains around the San Luis Valley so we can monitor the valley full time, 24/7. And we're going to establish a Skywatch channel on the local cable system in the valley so that people can have a channel that shows, a flipping image from all these different cameras showing the valley. And if something happens, all the cameras will be have motion tracking and zero in on this object so we can do some hard scientific research.
And our time is up.
Cool.
We look forward to doing a longer interview with you. We will soon.
Cool.
And maybe you'll know a little bit more whether or not this was just a wives' tale about human mutilation case or not.
I'm definitely going to look into that. Yeah, that's very frightening. I hope it's not true.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Okay, thanks for having me, Jerry.
I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away. We'll be right back. If you are a UFO show buff, can't get enough UFO programming, we suggest you go to our UFOshowstogo.com website regularly. Bookmark us. We put all of our UFO programming there as a link. It's easy to find. Simply go to UFOshowstogo.com. It's available as a podcast, MP3, or Windows Media downloads. Either way, listen or download, we do our best to give you the latest in UFO news. I'm an Angel Fire. I'm Jerry Pippin, and this is the 2010 Paranormal Symposium. And one of the great things about doing these remote broadcasts is you meet some very interesting people. And this man I'm about to introduce, I've actually met him before. I just didn't know it. He probably didn't introduce to me, but he was at an audience there when we did something from Roswell 1 year. Clifford Mahudi, how are you?
Very fine.
And you go to a lot of these things, I take it.
I go to a lot of different conventions, the Roswell, the UFO Congress in Laughlin, and for example, this is my first time here at Angel Fire. I've been trying to come to this for many years, but I do get involved with a lot of these meetings locally and nationwide.
Well, tell the audience why.
The reason that I go to these conventions and these meetings is because I, as a Zuni Indian, we have a lot of background history about the star people. We have a lot of star knowledge. Our whole systems are based upon the beginnings when we were given protocols on a lot of different systems that we have. And my involvement with this type of meetings is to learn about where the rest of the world is at on a time schedule of what the Indians, American Indian community knows about especially about the past and the future. And so my background as an engineer and as a member of a medicine order in Zuni gives me an opportunity to compare notes, if you may, on what the rest of the world is doing in terms of finding out what is happening throughout the whole universe, primarily on this planet.
Now, how are we doing, the rest of the world?
My experience so far is that within the last 30 years, that we as Indian people are now realizing that the rest of the world is at an awakening stage within the last 30 years.
So let's expand on this a little bit for our listeners. It's no secret that Native Americans seem to have an insight into paranormal activity that none of the rest of us have. And you're talking about UFOs as well, right?
That is true. We have, strictly speaking about the Zuni culture and Zuni community, we're isolated close to the Four Corners area, and we've had UFO activities as far as our ancestors or our grandfathers tell us since the beginning of time. That beginning of time, we do not really know. But within my lifetime, I've had experiences since I was 10 years old, which I'm 66 right now, so it's been about 55 years since I've had experiences with it. And because we were an isolated tribe away from the rest of the world, the teachings that were given me when I was a young man and when I was growing up was in a way isolated. But however, after so many years of that and then get exposed to the other world, which is the outside the reservation, I've learned quite a lot since I was 10 years old.
Now, you decided to document this in a book or something? I mean, you seem to have a lot of things that people need to know.
Well, I have been asked, and I have been sort of guided to that within the last 5 years, because my involvement with the UFO community is a comparative analysis of what we as Indian people know and what the rest of the world is doing in terms of documentation, experiences, encounters, and those type of activities. Now, recently means 3 years ago, I retired from a full-time job as an engineer, and I'm back full-time at my reservation. So I think that I am have enough notes and enough background information to perhaps start writing about these things.
Well, I hope you do, because I just have a hunch there's a lot of information there. Tell me, are the Zunis, I hear this about Native American tribes and don't know about this tribe, are they star people?
The Zuni system, the tribe itself, has a lot of connection with the star people. And if you look at the mythology, which is a history of our tribe, uh-huh, and several southwestern Pueblo tribes, since they don't have a written history, but it's through mythology, through religious system, through spirituality, we are directly connected with the star people and the star protocols provided by them somewhere way back in time.
And what would those protocols be?
Well, first of all, there's two basic things. First of all is we're the caretakers of the earth. That is our direct charge. The second thing is that we have been, in our history and our mythology, we have been given protocols in how to live the lives and to also be a group to demonstrate how we're supposed to take care of the earth and also how to take care of mankind throughout the whole planet Earth.
Well, from just my viewpoint, it doesn't look like we're doing too good of a job.
Well, I think that what happened was that it's just like anything else. There's a lot of influences that occurred in the history which deviated from the original mission that we were given.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because that in any system, it's not a perfect system. However, the only thing perfect about our instructions were those people that gave us the orders in how to maintain our lives on this planet. However, we have deviated from that for many, many reasons.
And when you talk to this and your friends there on the reservation, acquaintances and family and everything, is this a pretty prevalent notion that you have, or do they share it?
The American Indian tribes are very hush-hush about their backgrounds,
history. We know that. We tried to find out a lot of things.
Well,
I don't get a lot of information, but I try.
Well, I think
that's part of the thing down in Dulce, even. It's mixed in with sacred legends, and nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, it's commonly known as taboos.
Uh-huh.
And there are a lot of taboos with each individual tribes. And as a whole, there are so many taboos because some of these things it's common knowledge. It's been with us for centuries. And the other thing, too, is that when our country was invaded way back 500 years ago, there was a lot of openness with the invaders. However, if
anybody reads history, the American Indian was double-crossed, really.
Well, absolutely. I think this is what has happened. The other thing, too, is that there's a lot of what is commonly known as esoteric knowledge that are kept within the orders of so many different groups with individual tribes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a commonality among the pueblos in the orders of medicine orders, the priesthood societies, the Kachina societies, and there's a commonality, but however, there's a distinction because of languages, of location, and also of the time frames that each one of them have. Each pueblo has their origin, like the Hopis and the Zunis came from the Grand Canyon, from the emergence. I believe that the other pueblos, their emergence places are like in Colorado. Up here, we're sitting here in Taos, New Mexico, with the Taos Indians within their own boundaries of where the emergence is. But a lot of this information is sort of kept secret. And because of the sacred and because of the religious and the spirituality that's involved.
Yeah, that's the reason I was getting at it when I asked you about your friends and family and other people back on the reservation, how they feel about you out here publicly talking about things. Are you revealing secrets or...
No.
You think it's time to reveal secrets?
There are, because of my status within the orders that I belong to in Zuni, I am not allowed to do that. However, the common knowledge that I am conveying to the rest of the world is an interpretation. The interpretation is one of the hardest things to do because we in the United States of America, our language is English. You look at the American Indian tribes, each one of them has their languages. Even within their own tribes, the dialects are different, the same tribal, the tribal's language.
That's interesting. I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's a commonality among a lot of races around the world, the dialects. I wonder how that ever got started. you know, why we're not all speaking the same language.
Well, when I asked a question among my elders when I was having my teachings, was that different groups, for example, my Zuni tribe is a composite of many different peoples from different parts of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say universe, the universe would mean that where did our teachings come from? Maybe we were here on Earth, but our teachings came from different parts of the universe, different star systems, different planets, different parts of the universe where there was a lot of distinct knowledge, distinct practices, distinct protocols that were given these people by the star people. And we have direct connection with the star people. And the thing that is really hard to impress upon anybody is the interpretation.
Have you personally had an encounter with...
I have had not direct encounters, uh-huh. but I have seen UFOs since I was a young man, a young kid. One of the very interesting things that I have with the gentleman that's here at this conference is Travis Walton. Travis Walton's experience happened on November 5th of 1975. My experience happened 1 month later on December 5th of 1975 when I had an encounter with a UFO.
And was it, what location was that?
This was right outside of Zuni, New Mexico, where my village is.
So that's not that far away from where Travis was.
No. And it's within the time frame, and with this, it's like about no more than 100 miles from my reservation or the location of this encounter to where Travis was at on the Mogollon Rim.
What happened with you the December 5th?
1975.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, we had we were coming in about 2 o'clock in the morning, coming in from Arizona in almost a new car. And I have had, I have seen UFOs come out in that part of the country. And on the south side, we're coming in from a west to east direction toward the village, about 2 miles outside the village. We saw this, there's three of us, my brother and his friend, and it was her car that we were driving. It's almost a brand new, it was a Ranchero, a Ford Ranchero type vehicle. And it only had maybe about 2,000 or 3,000 miles on it, so it was brand new almost. Well, I saw this thing coming over on the southern horizon. It was like a bright red light, between red and orange light. And I didn't want to say anything, but as it kept coming closer, I said, "Look over on the south side." I said, "There is something coming. I don't want to tell you, but look at it." So we came, and then about a mile, maybe a mile and a half from the village. We're getting close to the village. And in particular, there's the village's sewer ponds are on the west side, and the sewer ponds would be about a half a mile off the road on the south side between the highway where we were at. At that time, this UFO was orange in color, and between the orange and the yellow, and it sort of like parked right there. And before that happened, we were driving this car down, and the light started going dim. And about a mile, no more than a mile, the car completely just...
It died.
Died. Mm-hmm. No engine. The engine died. There was no more lights, and just stopped. It was about... I'd say it's about maybe 10, 20 degrees at night, December 5th, in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But we could see this thing sitting over there half a mile, and it was so funny. They said, "Why would it land on above the sewer ponds?" Well, when we were looking at it, and a beam came down from underneath the vehicle, I mean the UFO, and it shot down my proximity of that location was the sewer ponds, and it looked like about a green, yellowish light beam that shot down. out of the right. UFOs. It was bright.
Uh-huh.
So we got out of the car. We ran down. We started running down to the village, and it was cold. And of course, but there was no cars. Two o'clock in the morning, between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. There's nobody on that road.
Right.
So we kept saying, "Let's keep running." And about that time, something snapped inside of me. He said, "Well, we can't run forever. It's too cold for one thing." Anyway, when we ran, it's going to take a while for us to get to the village. So let's hide underneath this culvert. We walked. We crawled into a culvert, which is about 3 feet in diameter, 3 to 4 feet in diameter. We sat in there for about 30 minutes, and of course we were getting cold. And I said, "Well, let's get out of here and let's see if we can get a rest, and we'll just start running." Well, we got out after about 30 minutes, and we got on the highway. And on the where our car was parked, there was a car that was coming. It had lights on it. So he said, I told my brother and his girlfriend, he said, "Whatever you do, let's just get in the middle of the highway and start waving our hands. They got to stop." And this car took forever to come. I think it was maybe going about maybe 5 miles per hour.
Oh, really?
And so it finally stopped. And because we were scared, we were cold, we automatically jumped into the car. And this is an Indian reservation. We all know each other. I mean, yeah. who's gonna question you? We jumped in there, and what was odd about it is that we were just jabbering away. Did you see that thing up there? It's still sitting there. We're still sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we looked in there, the light was so the dashboard, what may be like a dashboard, was not a conventional vehicle dashboard. It was sort of like a round thing, and there was a lights around it, but the instruments were not like any other thing. But what was really funny was that this vehicle, if the old days, there used to be straps on the back. I guess those were for hand straps in the old vehicles, and they were hanging loose. And I said, "This is an odd looking car." But the driver was there. I thought I knew him. I talked to him. He didn't answer back. And there was a guy in the back. He was sitting in there, and he was holding on to Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy dolls. And he was just looking at us, and they were not talking. Well, they drove into the village, and wow. They did not stop at any stop sign. Now, we're going 5 miles an hour maximum speed.
Were they stoned?
We don't know, because I could see them with this light in there, but it was like it was a strange vehicle.
They never really said much to you.
No, they didn't say anything.
Nothing.
And I could not hear the engine, but I do know about old timer engines, the cars, especially like
Buicks. They're noisy.
Huh?
They're noisy.
They were very quiet in those
days.
You know,
that.
The 8-cylinder and the 12-cylinder engines were very.
I didn't realize
yes,
that.
Yes, I remember those cars. So we jumped out of it. It just happened that he drove by my parents' house, and we said, "Let's get out of here." We jumped out, and those cars kept moving. It didn't stop.
You jumped out while he was going 5 miles an hour.
Right. So we jumped out. We ran into the house. We told my brother was over there, my parents, and of course, they thought we were drunk.
Yeah, you're right.
But the strange part of it is that we were excited. We talked to my brother was in bed already. He said, "What are you guys talking about?" I said, "Come on out here." But in the meantime, the UFO came and it followed us.
Okay.
I didn't realize it while we were in the car.
Uh-huh.
Well, it stopped above our house. And I would say it was no more than 100 feet in the air, maybe 100, maybe 200 feet. That's the first time I saw. I used to carry a set of Navy nighttime binoculars,
mm-hmm.
very powerful binoculars. I took them out and I looked up there and I could see three of them walking around. It's good in like a dome structure.
And there were people inside walking.
They were
something.
Not people. They were like real short guys.
Okay.
They were only maybe about 3 or 4 feet high.
Traditional grays, probably.
Could have been, but you know, I could not tell because of the light in there. It was, but they were in there. There's about maybe about three of them.
Wow!
And then after that, I mean, we just got cold and we just got scared and we took off and we went back in there and I'm sure it stayed there and it probably took off, but we didn't want to deal with it anymore.
Well, I can understand that.
So that's my.
This sounds like something out of a horror movie. I love it.
You know, when the reason I never told anybody these two.
They never said anything.
No.
Nothing at all.
And that was so strange about it.
And when you went back to get the car, it started?
Yes. One funny thing about it is I left a pair of gloves in there. And, of course, in those days, the reason we were in Arizona was to go because they closed the bars at 2 o'clock. So we went to get some liquor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So when we came back, the liquor was gone, and my gloves were gone. But we went back the next day, and we jumped in the vehicle, started the engine. It just started right away, like nothing happened.
Wow.
So this was.
So the ETs were thirsty.
Probably.
We could go on for hours. Yeah. You got anything you'd like to close with, I mean, that we've left out or you'd like to bring out for our audience?
Well, so one of the things that, going back to the Native American knowledge is that there's a lot of things that are happening on reservations. It always has been, but it's more becoming more prevalent right now. We talk about Dulce. We talk about a lot of different, for example, on the Navajo Reservation, the Skinwalker Ranch.
And there's been a lot of reports that could never verify up near Flagstaff or back this way on the Navajo Reservation. A lot of things happening.
Is that the around Deocon and
up through there?
That was back in about.
I never could get anybody to talk to me about it.
Well, there's some people that know about it.
Okay.
I think right now I know about it. But I think that there is.
We had somebody that lived in that area that did some producing for me,
mm-hmm.
and they tried for several days to get some information. Really couldn't.
Well, they
didn't exactly there. They lived in Sedona, but
yeah.
But that was a rumor I was trying to track down.
Well, it's for real. The other thing too is that there's a lot of taboos. It's been with us since the beginning of time, so we have to maintain that. The taboos, because again, it's sometimes they feel they the Indian think it's maybe it's personal, so they don't talk about it. And if they talk about it, then you get ostracized. They say, "Well, you're crazy. You're not. What have you been drinking?" That type
of
ridicule.
They don't know themselves that you're probably telling the truth.
Right. So,
well, Clifford, it's really been an interesting experience, and I love that story. I won't forget that right away.
Well, it's
next time I see a car going 5 miles an hour in the middle of the desert, and I got a guy in the back seat and a guy in the front seat, yeah, that's what it sounds like. Little tippy time. Anyway, Clifford Mahudi, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Jerry Pippin. We're here at Angel. I'd like to take an opportunity here to talk to you about our websites. We've been adding programs and adding programs, and sometimes it's difficult to find what you're looking for. First of all, we have a search mechanism on each of our websites, and you can click, like if it's jerrypippin.com or if ipodshows.net, just search the websites, put in the name of what you're looking for, and it will come up. Check us out, won't you? Often. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we are an Angel Fire Resort in New Mexico, and we're here for the annual symposium, Paranormal Symposium, and this year a film festival. And we have Travis Walton with us, a man of some renown. People know Travis, probably the most famous abductee of all, I guess, from Fire in the Sky and his movie. Now, you got a new book out, don't you?
Yeah.
Welcome to the show, by the way.
Okay, well, good to be here. It's the same book, but just an updated edition. Additional material and illustrations and whatnot.
I talked to you once, and you probably would like to have updated that movie a little bit.
Yeah, I had a problem with the departures from reality, but I had to come to terms with that because once I signed my rights away, I did not have the power to get them to stick to the what really happened. But
yeah, you know, Travis, there's a good part of that, though, and that is that you draw big crowds. People come and see you. And so you can get the real message out.
Yeah, I think I've got a responsibility now to kind of correct some misconceptions. And not just those created by the movie. You know, there's a lot of people out there doing anything they can to get attention and try to latch on to what happened and become important for a little while. But, you know, here's the real story, and all the imposters and whatnot will fade away.
We probably won't go into detail much on the story. We've done several interviews, and we've also, you know, they're familiar with the movie, but I have a few questions about that before we get it, move on to other things. And basically, do you ever see any of those guys, those logger buddies?
Yeah, I see some of them occasionally. You know, there's been long periods of times where I didn't see them, but Kenny Peterson moved back to the area, and John, he's working the night shift at Walmart, so I don't see him too often, but I have run on him to him two or three times. And then here a few months ago, Steve Pierce called me up. I hadn't heard from him in about 30 years. And so,
been that long, huh?
Yeah. But it was kind of good to touch base again. And every one of them, you know, stand by what happened to us to this day and haven't wavered a bit.
So, tell me, perspective. 30 years is a long time. Has your perspective about all of this changed from?
Well, yeah, I think it's gradually matured in a way. You know, I continue to learn more about, you know, the way this sort of event affects the world and people and the so-called experts. But you know, my philosophy has kind of matured over time too. I've come to terms with some of the things that used to really annoy me a lot. You know, people who, you know, make up stories about what happened and things like that, you know.
Yeah, I noticed they were making up a few again recently on the Internet. It keeps going on and on.
Yeah, but, you know, they get exposed for the frauds that they are, and as time goes on, they people more and more can see there's a pattern here, you know. But still, you know, over time I've learned a lot, and I've developed a better perspective on what happened. I was pretty frightened by the whole thing at the time it happened. It was very traumatic and took me a while to get over. And so, you know, I've gradually come to realize that a lot of the negativity of what I experienced there had to do with just the way it came off, you know, the fact that I regained consciousness in pain and so short of breath, just gasping for air, really. You know, all that combined to make me react a lot more negatively than might not have really been warranted by you know, what it was.
Yeah. When we talk about that experience, were you, while you were gone, familiar with the idea that you were gone that long?
Well, I didn't know how long it was until they told me. When I was picked up by my family, they could tell that I didn't know, and they told me, you know, you've been gone for 5 days, and that was quite a shock.
Yeah, we talked about it one time when you got loose or free, how did that happen exactly? How did you get away from it?
Well,
they just let you loose?
They dumped me off. I woke up and in time to see the craft leaving, and so, you know.
So you walked over and found a phone booth.
Yeah, so, you know.
Today you might be in trouble. The phone booths are pretty hard to find.
Yeah, so it was important that they did drop me off in a place where I could get help. And the fact that I was returned at all is pretty significant. So in hindsight, I can look at it and think, well, maybe it wasn't quite as threatening as I thought because, you know, if they were totally evil, they wouldn't need to return me at all. As a matter of fact, if they hadn't, my crew mates would have continued to be accused of murder, and it would have covered up the fact that they were there at all, you know. The world would have come to believe that they had just made up a story to cover up for a murder. So,
do you? What was the difference between the creatures that you saw and those in the movie?
Well, there was quite a bit of difference. They were small humanoids. They didn't go, you know, create jellyfish or something. But you know, the creatures I saw were of a different color. They were a grayish white, and they had very large eyes, and they were more humanoid in appearance than the what was depicted in the movie. But the movie's one concession to what I actually saw was showing the actor encountering these large-eyed spacesuits. As a matter of fact, that's the only spoken word in the abduction sequence. So I guess what they were trying to get at there was the reports of large-eyed creatures really was because they were wearing these suits. But, of course, that was just Hollywood there.
Did they communicate at all, telepathic, or was it, did you hear a voice?
No, I did not hear any voices in my head or anything like that. And I've come to think that perhaps that might have been because of the beam hitting me, some kind of an injury, because the fact that I came to at all unexpectedly. Normally, I understand they have a way of controlling people, but they didn't seem to have any control of me at all. And that may have been not because I had some special strength to resist them, but maybe just because there was some sort of organic disorganization in my brain just because of being hit there with that beam.
And do you remember the beam pulling you up?
No. All I remember is this electric shock sort of feeling. Felt like I'd just been hit from behind and didn't see it coming, and I blacked out. But the crew, you know, very vividly described, you know, how the beam just blasted me back through the air, and they immediately concluded that I was dead.
Really?
Yeah. They said to each other, yelled out, "It killed him. He's dead. Let's get out of here. We're next," you know.
And so if they'd hung around, do you think they might have come after them, too, or do you have any idea?
They certainly believe that, and they had every reason to think that could happen to them. It might have been just
that. So you got out of the truck and ran up there, right?
Yeah, and that, of course, is the main thing that brought it on me, is just being foolish enough to get so close like that.
Now, when we talk about these 5 days, that's a long time, really, to keep somebody.
Yeah, it was.
What were they after?
Well, you know, some people, and a theory that I kind of favor, I don't know for sure, is that maybe they felt that they had to clean up the mess, they had to correct the damage, that I was injured by this beam, maybe even killed, and they had to fix things. So that, again, implies some sort of a moral responsibility in the event, in spite of the fact that, you know,
so
I brought it on myself.
Necessarily as evil as you thought originally.
Yeah, that's the way I'm leaning now. I don't know for sure, but I can see how, you know, I probably thought that to a much greater degree than I might have should have based on the evidence, just because, you know, the way it happened to.
You have any idea where they were from, or?
No, they didn't communicate with me, and I was trying, but it was a one-way street. They weren't responding, neither the aliens or the human-looking beings that I encountered.
Now, in the book, you revised it somewhat. So new stuff in there?
Yeah, some new stuff, you know, just an update on a lot of the people, the things that have happened to them in the meantime, and a few new discoveries and some new illustrations, too.
Physically, were you damaged for a while? Do you have any problems now?
No, I don't have any lingering medical
problems.
You look,
you're a very handsome guy, and you get around well. And
yeah, I've been totally, you know, healthy. Matter of fact, in the last 25 years, I've never had a single day off work from sickness. I never called in sick.
Well, maybe everyone should be zapped.
Yeah, apparently.
Of course, I'm making light of a bad situation. You've dealt with this now pretty well because you're out speaking.
Yeah, and you know, you do have to have a sense of humor because in hard times it gets you through things.
And I you know, on our show we have people contacting us all the time. And somebody contacted me recently and said they were going to come up to Tennessee and see you. So you're making a lot of speeches later this month.
Yeah, I've got quite a... you know, if anybody wants to know if I'm appearing near where they are, they can just go to my website and check my schedule, travis-walton.com. And it's being updated all the time.
And we have a link to that.
Yeah, new stuff being added to it. So
Now, it seems that there for a while you just withdrew from everything. Now you're back... you know, being very public.
Yeah, you know, there's been periods of time where I just didn't want to talk about it anymore. Actually, this last period had a lot more to do with just the fact that I was working too many hours. I was working 12 hours a day for the last 11 years at a paper recycling plant. And I just, you know, they were going to let me have all the overtime I could kill myself with. So,
right.
So I finally had to
take advantage of it.
I finally just had to walk away. They were going to cut out all the overtime anyway, and they wound up for a while cutting back production to where they actually shut the place down 1 week out of the month, and then that became 2 weeks. And so it was a good time to leave. And plus, I kind of felt like I was leaving a certain responsibility behind here. Something really profound happened to me, and I was getting a lot of emails from people who was asking, where can I get a copy of this book? And all they were finding was people selling their used copies online for $100, $200 a copy, and I thought that was pretty outrageous. So I finally decided I needed to just update the book and get it back out there.
And they can get that through your website?
Yeah, I got ripped off on the previous edition, so I just decided I'd just do it myself this time. So I'm the publisher, and I'm the only source right now. And they can contact me through the website for ordering information.
Yeah, a lot of abductees that contact me, and many of them, they all wonder whether it really happened or not. At one time or another, then they come to some kind of understanding.
Yeah. Hey,
did you have that problem?
Well, you know, I can understand that to a certain extent. And before I reunited with my crewmates, I was doing some little reality testing of my own.
Uh-huh.
You know, had my mind slipped a cog. Everybody was trying to push that on me. Sheriff had a theory that the crew had hit me over the head and slipped me drugs or something, you know, but you know, once I talked to the other crew members and I kind of got a little better grip on things, you know, I realized, you know, we'd all experienced something quite profound, and it was as real as anything that had ever happened to me.
Now, Travis, you're a polite guy and very understanding with people. People talk to you all the time. These abductees tell their stories to you. Does that bother you?
Well, I've heard some good, solid stories, and I've heard some pretty far-out stuff that I consider a little bit too far out. But, you know, I don't like to point fingers, and I would never publicly, you know, say what stories I thought were good, solid stories and which weren't. Because, you know, I took great exception to people passing judgment on what happened to us without having even looked at the facts. So, you know, I quoted Emerson in my book, condemnation without examination is the height of ignorance. So yeah. I didn't want to be guilty of that myself. So if I haven't investigated a case, you know, really looked into it, you know, I'm not going to pass judgment on these cases. I have my own private opinion on or personal first impression, but that's as far as it goes until I...
Yeah, I understand. Now... any of these abductees you talk to, and some of them, as I said, you're a polite guy, so you listen to their stories more than them. You seem to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are they any of them similar to what you?
Well, I don't know about similarities, but I do, you know, hear reports on occasion that are solid, and I can recognize, you know, that this is the real deal. But you know, there is another phenomenon going on here that might even outnumber legitimate cases. It's more of a psychosocial phenomenon But
and we've talked about that in a previous show.
Yeah,
but and you don't even dismiss that.
I don't necessarily dismiss it. It might muddy the waters a bit, especially in terms of the mainstream media's perception of things. But you know, if good solid researchers would emphasize to the public that we recognize that there is, you know, the wheat and the chaff, you know, don't lump us all into one to one category. You hear this all the time in regard to say terrorism. You know, they say, well, don't paint all Muslims with the same brush that you would the extremists, and so, you know, that's necessary to do in all sorts of thinking, you know. Like, for instance, the Tea Party don't want to be known by the worst among them. So, you know, as much as possible, each person should be judged on their own merits, you know, and treat each case as a you know, to be judged individually.
When and did this affect you at all in a religious or spiritual nature?
Well, I consider myself a lifelong spiritual person, but not a religious person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, mainstream religion to me is not really where it's at for me. But I think it did broaden my perspective, my philosophy, in a more comprehensive sort of way that I think in a way that I've actually benefited from something that otherwise I wish hadn't happened. You know?
Right, I understand. Just like I was talking about the movie, the benefit is people still come and you're able to get your message out, even though they didn't.
And the movie, although they didn't tell it exactly how it was, it does leave people with the kinds of emotional experience that we lived through. And so in that sense, it achieves what I hoped, you know, just opening up their minds and a willingness to look at the facts.
As I say, you're a nice guy, and it's late in the evening now, and we've been going all day, and we're going to have to wrap this up in a couple of minutes, but you were nice enough to come back and had a nice little dinner, I think.
Well, good talking with you, Jerry. I'm getting a little hoarse, but...
Yeah. Now, reason I mentioned that is I got to ask you, I wanted to ask you last time, what were these ETs, or if they were... something else? What were they doing in the White Mountains?
Well, I don't know. There seems to be a kind of a preference for
activities.
I mean,
there seems to be a lot of things happening up here.
Well, not necessarily. I think they kind of prefer activity in remote areas.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, that was pretty remote. And so what they were up to, I don't know. The researchers came to the site and recorded some very unusual magnetic readings right in the clearing where the craft came down. And then in the following summer, I found out that the federal government sent a crew of people in there to map out magnetic readings for some reason. So I always thought that was done from the air, but they were doing it on the ground, and there was a whole team of people. So that kind of shows that they were...
It is an interesting fact.
Seems like they were following up on something that the UFO researchers had uncovered.
Yeah, do you ever go to that spot?
I try to avoid it as much as possible, but I have been back on occasion. I suppose it's time that I very carefully return just to check on certain things. There was a profound change in the growth of the trees at that site, so I want to see how those are doing, because there was a huge forest fire in Arizona that killed trees. Well, a half a million acres and trees burned up. So the fire did burn through that area, but most of the trees that had this phenomenal growth did survive. So I want to see if they've continued to survive and thrive or just what happened there. And there's some other things I need to check on research-wise.
So you're still doing a little investigation yourself?
Yeah. You know, for instance, no one thought of checking the trees where I was returned. You know, we've done all this research at the site where I was taken, but we haven't checked the trees at the site of return. So I'm interested in going back and seeing if the same effect happened there, too.
Do you think you can find that spot?
Yeah, there's been a little bit of a change. They sort of straightened and widened the road a little bit there, but
uh-huh.
A lot of the same trees that were near enough to that craft when it left that it stirred their branches are probably close enough to have experienced the effect if it's still, you know.
When you came back to the story, no one believed you?
Well, actually, it was worse than that. The town was divided. And, like, you know, the town marshal didn't believe it a bit, but his wife did. But his brother, the county deputy, didn't believe it, did believe it, but his wife didn't. And so, you know, so just among those four people, you know, there was that kind of division. So throughout the town, you had people on both sides of the issue, and a lot of people didn't want to even speak their mind because they, you know.
They didn't want to think about it.
They didn't want to be criticized by people who had the other opinion. So,
yeah.
So it, and then there was rumors flying like crazy, but over time, a lot of those rumors and the truth has gotten filtered back out. And belief and acceptance has grown over time. You know, people watch me in my every move, everywhere I go. So now they realize that a lot of the rumors about what I'm like are not at all true, and they've come to know the real me, and
so
that helps.
So you're not a double agent or a super con man or anything like that?
Right.
So you're pretty well accepted these days.
Yeah. It's much better than it used to be.
Yeah. Now, your plans are to make as many of these speaking engagements as possible?
Yeah, I try to get the word out. I am not sure exactly where this is all going, but I feel like I do have a responsibility.
In other words, you ride this horse to it drops.
Play the cards of life's deal.
And I mean that in the best sense.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. Things could change, you know, but I do want to, you know, make a positive difference if I can.
Travis Walton, it's always a pleasure to see you. And
good talking to you again, Jerry.
You're listening to these programs that were produced at Angel Fire Resort in Angel Fire, New Mexico, up in northern New Mexico. And we have Pete Gregg coming up next, and he's going to talk about the sex habits of ETs. Don't go away. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road, and I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com. We're at Angel Fire, and I'm Jerry Pippin, and this is the 2010 Paranormal Symposium and Film Festival, and D. Gregg is here, and we'll get into a pretty interesting subject. Actually, it's a question that I've always asked myself, and D. actually brought it out of the closet, so to speak, and lectured about it. But first of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that he just gave me a nice little book here. And this is your new book, D, right?
Yes, it is. Sure is.
And it's called A Simple Explanation of ETs?
That's exactly correct. And I wrote it fair as simple as I could because I'm going to be teaching it to people who are just walking off the street to my class who's starting from zero, and so I made it simple enough that anybody could do that.
Now, your class is here in New Mexico?
Yes, New Mexico State University.
And when's it scheduled again?
It'll start the first Wednesday in October.
And it's a night course?
Yes. I've already been approved by the board and the coordinator, and we've set it up, and it's ready to go.
Well, you're one of the few people teaching about ETs and contact and all of that.
Yes, I'm a member
in academia.
I'm a member of the UFO Educator. There's probably 20, 25 of us at any given time. There's probably not more than a half dozen of us that are actually teaching it at a university. Uh-huh. So it's fairly fair, and I feel honored, privileged to get to do it, that the university has let me do it.
Is that still open for enrollment down
there?
Oh,
yes. Oh, yes.
And they can contact the university? And
Yes, if anybody would like to do that. Sure thing.
Okay, now I've always wondered about ETs. Are they interested in sex? If they're not, they seem like they're missing something.
Let me tell you what, they're not interested in sex per se with themselves, but they're interested in a breeding program because they are doing a human alien hybrid program. And so they abduct the women for this and impregnate them. For sex themselves, they don't have the equipment for the most part. They have no genitalia.
Uh-huh.
And a part of the breeding program is these hybrid fetuses now do have genitalia, and presumably they can start breeding them. It's my understanding one would have to breed for about through 5 generations to get them so that they could pass as humans. And there are ones who do pass as humans.
Well, we've heard abduction stories for more than that decade, so
yes.
I guess some of them are among us.
They are. Some of them are among us. The ones that I think in particular that we couldn't identify are the Nordics. The Nordics, they're just a little taller than we are and a little healthier looking, muscular. They're beautiful looking people, and some are blondes like you'd expect, but there are other redheads and brunettes in there. I would think they could pass among us without any trouble. Now, the little grays, their breeding program, they're trying to breed human aliens that can pass among us. And that's what I was talking about, maybe about 5 generations before they can pass among us. But they are trying to pass among us now because we find them from time to time, so we know they are.
Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. What do you mean we find them from time to time?
They are identified by either abductees or ufologists who are studying the field. And most of the time, the way they find them is not by how they look. They've taken care of that. They look pretty much like us. They've learned some skills about how to drive cars and stuff. But where they usually, you can really find them is that they don't understand the nuances and the subtleties of our civilization. There's one of them was he wanted to seduct a 16-year-old girl, but he had no idea how to do it. He told her he was going to give her a job, and then when they got there, well, he told her he wanted to have sex with her. Yeah, it's that sort of thing that they don't understand.
Just don't bluntly say that you're going to buy him a glass of wine first.
Yeah, yeah.
And probably should pick somebody 18.
Yeah, certainly. But, but you know, they abduct our females as young as 13. Right after puberty, and they prefer to start young, and they abduct them throughout their lives often.
So I've always wondered what happens. They impregnate the abductee, the 13-year-old, let's say.
Yeah.
And they take the fetus. Is that the way it works?
Yes.
They don't allow it to go to term.
No. They take the fetus at 3 months. And they go in and cut it loose inside the womb. There will be a little gray right there with a cylinder of fluid, and they will put it in this cylinder of fluid, and then they will take it back and put it into the artificial wombs. And they grow them to term then in the artificial wombs. And why they take them at 3 months, I've never heard anyone say. It's just that's how they do it. They probably have a reason.
Perhaps it needs the body of the host for to develop the first. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, well, they have to get the embryo and the fetus going in the womb, and apparently, after 3 months, they don't need them to do that anymore.
How much do we really know about this, and what's? I mean, how do we really know? Would you know from abductees through retrograde to hypnosis or what?
Through abductees. Bud Hopkins has worked with more than 1,000. Daryl Sims, who's here at this symposium, has worked with more than 1,000. Others have made estimates how many people are being abducted, and it varies on the low end from several hundred thousand to 15 million people that have been abducted. They abduct a few males because they need some sperm, but mostly they just abduct females for the egg. And then they mix their DNA with the egg.
Yeah, I've had a few males talk to me about abductions.
Yeah.
So they take the sperm from the male donor.
Yes.
And then I'm trying to figure out how it actually works. I guess they impregnate the the woman with the male sperm, but
which has had the hybrid DNA, so that they impregnate them.
So
with
they
a,
take the male sperm and they do something with it.
They put their cloning or something.
I don't know. What
they put their DNA with the egg when they fertilize it with the sperm, and then they go and implant that fertilized egg inside the female and let it grow for 3 months.
What I'm getting at, Dee, is what happens when these babies are born? I mean, is there a huge nursery someplace?
Well,
we've heard people say they see ships. They seem to even show it to the mothers sometimes.
Let me tell you the story about that. You're right on to something I just told to the group. Yes, they have a nursery, and this lady who had been abducted, and she'd had a fetus cut from her, and they told her, we're going to show you something wonderful. And, you know, she kind of said, well, that would be a first if they did. And they took her down the hall and into another room, and there was a chair. You see very few chairs. Abductees report very few chairs, so we don't think ETs can sit down, and we don't think they bend at the right place or even need to sit down. But they told her to sit down in the chair. And so then a nurse came in holding a baby, and she says, isn't he beautiful? He's yours. And she looked, and she said, this was an ugly, scrawny little thing. Eyes are much too big. Head's much too big. She's grotesque. And she said, no, he's ugly. He's not mine. Take him away. Well, that didn't work. The nurse didn't do that. She said, you must hold him. And she said, no, no, take him away. So then she said, you must touch him or he will die. And she reached out and touched him. And as she did, the nurse thrust that baby into her arms and said, nurse the baby. She said, you're crazy. I don't have anything for the baby. I don't have any milk. And she said, nurse the baby. Put him to your breast. So she did this ugly little fetus thing and found the nipple and had a weak sucking reflex. And to her amazement, she began to lactate. And she was feeding the baby. And then a strange thing happened. She looked down at this ugly little creature, malformed and stuff, and she thought, he needs me. And she began to bond with him. And she pulled him closer to her. And she continued to bond with him. And she knew this was a mistake. So they were going to take this baby. And they did. They came back and took the baby. And she screamed, stop, give me my baby back. And that didn't do any good. The nurse took it back to the nursery, which is what we're talking about. And they took her home. And she woke up the next day frustrated, nervous, depressed, sort of knowing why, sort of not knowing why. But yes, they have a nursery. There's one of the things we don't know, though, is after their babies, say that the first generation of them, what happens to them as they're going up through two or three more generations before they can pass? We see very few of those. I have a few in my book and in the lecture, and most of the time they had to do with a hybrid having sex with a male. But we don't find many of them, and not nearly enough to account for the numbers that they are abducting. So maybe they're off somewhere we just don't know, and they don't need us to know. And so they're very secretive anyway. You know, they don't want you to take their picture or in particular.
How did you come across the story with this lady?
With the lady?
Yeah.
The lady.
That's a great story.
Thank you. And I must tell you, it is a composite. Everything I told you has happened to an abductee.
Okay,
but in order to get the thing straight and not tell you about five or six different women, then I made a composite. This is what typically happens to them.
Uh-huh.
And I got
most of this
information were from Bud Hopkins, Dr. Johnny Mack, Dr. Jacobs, Daryl Sims is here,
and
I put this together just so that I could teach it in a coherent manner,
right.
And I haven't put anything in that it doesn't happen. All of this happened. Maybe all of it happens to every woman. I don't know, because they will report parts of it in another woman. They will report other parts, and I thought that would be too confusing. I just gave them a composite.
So when they develop this breeding program,
mm-hmm.
and it goes to the fifth generation,
yeah,
and they have someone that's pretty much human. Do they come into this population, or what happens?
We found them in the population. Mm-hmm. That they know how to drive cars. Like I was telling about the guy who told a 16-year-old had a job for. trying to think of others.
Uh-huh.
Mostly.
So these people know they are hybrids?
Yes. Interesting enough, I asked Yvette Smith about that, who's a researcher, and I said, do they know that they're hybrids? She said, yes. Do they recognize other hybrids? She said, yes. I said, do they breed with each other? She said, no, I don't think so. I said, do they breed with humans? She says, yeah, that's the idea.
Uh-huh.
So they're here. And
So there are people in our population who know that they're hybrids.
They
and they're seeking out other human women or men to breed.
Yes. It's even more insidious than that. They retain the ability to read your mind and control your mind when they're working among us. And if you're going to ask me why they're among us, I'd like the group I told already this morning, we simply don't know why. We know what they're doing. We don't yet know why they're doing it. I mean, a lot of speculation is they're going to try to take over. This is a methodology of taking over the Earth, but we don't know that for sure. They're very secretive.
Yeah, we start out five generations back with a gray.
Yeah.
And now we've got this almost, it would be a nationality. It would be, it's not really a species. It's a human. Almost.
I just say hybrid.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They'll have powers that humans don't have.
And what are those powers?
Well, like I was telling you about, they can read your mind,
mm-hmm.
and they can influence your mind.
Well, they have so little mind control.
Yes, they do. Now, you're going to think again why, and I don't know why, but I can, guess why. They have their own agenda for sure.
So if they're mind control, they probably don't have much trouble breeding with other humans later.
I would guess so, Jerry, but yeah, we're just guessing.
I hate to get into that. But so they can do all sorts of things.
My opinion is this. Yes, that's certainly true.
So these hybrids, fifth generation I'm talking about,
yeah,
they go to our colleges, and one of them might even go to your course.
They're among us, Jerry. We don't know to what extent. We don't know how many of them they are, how widespread this is, but they are there. I assume that as time goes on, we'll learn more and more about them and do that.
Yeah, well, and we don't know. It doesn't sound, I mean, they're so secretive, so immediately it sounds pretty nefarious.
Yeah, and we don't know all the reasons for secrecy. Is it because they don't want the population, our population, to know how widespread this is? How many of them they're doing, afraid of spreading panic to the population? Maybe they're violating the Eisenhower Treaty. They are violating the Eisenhower Treaty. We don't know if that's the reason they're being secret or not. Maybe they're violating, and I don't even know if this exists or not, the Galactic Federation. I read about it on the Internet, but when I try to trace it down, I don't find out whether there is such a thing or not. But mm-hmm. if there is, maybe they're in violation of it and they're wanting to hide. Another thought is maybe they're competing groups of these, and maybe they're hiding what they're doing from the other group. Now, I heard a couple of ufologists talking at a dinner one time. They didn't put this out, but overheard them saying that they thought the reptilians and the Nordics had been warring on the U.S., on this earth for 250,000 years. And she said the way they war is they don't kill each other like we do. They war by cloning, whatever that might mean.
So they're competing species, and this is a prize.
There are species that they're in direct conflict with each other. Yes, we know. There are good ones and there are bad ones, and we have reports about both kinds. Into the breeding program, most of those would be classified as the bad ones, although I do know a lady, she may be here at this convention, I haven't seen her yet, who has given them 17 fetuses through most of her child productive life from time to time. And I asked her about them, and I said, how do you feel about these hybrids that are out there that are your children? She said, oh, I'm very happy that I've been able to help America. I would also say this lady also has several implants, and they give her instructions to these implants. And I've never asked her directly, you know, if she's being influenced by them or not. But she seemed very happy about the whole thing.
It's a fascinating subject, Dee.
Thank you.
Could go on and on and on about it.
Thank you.
Now, what we all got a minute or two left.
Okay.
You're still investigating this subject we've been talking about, of course.
Yes, yes.
But what else interests you? I know you were in crop circles, but there's none here in New Mexico, are there?
Never been a crop circle reported in the state of New Mexico. I'm the field investigator for the International Crop Circle Association. If we ever have one, I have my little bag packed, and I'll go out and investigate it. But it's an easy job because we've never had one in the state of New Mexico.
That's an interesting...
The Angel Fire UFO landing site was discovered, that's the first word they put out, crop circles. Boy, my ears pricked up. I wanted to go investigate those, but as soon as I saw a picture of one, I said, No, that is not a crop circle. And I recognized it from Ted Phillips' work that it was a UFO landing site.
And there's no doubt about it in your mind about the UFO landing site?
Not really, because we have a UFO landing site in which a UFO was observed, and the people went out and looked at the site. Ted Phillips has got all this detail, and it was not identical, but very so much you couldn't miss it, like what we found here at Angel Fire. And we found a number of places where they had landed. And we found a place which I call the nesting area where they'd been landing and taking off over a period of years. And we know that because some of the vegetation would start to grow back in the place that they had denuded. And that's right here in Angel Fire.
Interesting. Dee, we could talk for hours. Thanks very much, Greg.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
It's always good. We're here at Angel Fire. I'm Jerry Pippin. I want to talk to you about a very interesting website indeed. It's called SedonaVisions.com. This website is operated by the daughter of the late Wendell Stevens and has a good selection of UFO books. However, it's unique because CC is a well-respected alternative figure specializing in everything that is unique. I'm talking about great gift ideas for Christmas. CC prides herself in keeping up with the latest innovations when it comes to keeping your body and spirit full of energy and good health. She has an exciting line of clothing, too, for both men and women. Clothes that look like new age, feel like cotton, but look like silk. On the website, you'll find information about the 13 different crystal skulls, herbs, and spices that cure. That's SedonaVisions.com, an exciting world of health and spiritual welfare. We're at Angel Fire, and this is in New Mexico, of course, and it's a beautiful place. And we are at the 2010 Paranormal Symposium and Film Festival. Chuck Wade was here last year. We've known Chuck for a long time. Chuck's done a lot of UFO research on the crash of St. Augustine.
That is correct.
And as far as things are going along, first of all, I'd be remiss, Chuck, if I didn't say it's a pleasure seeing you.
Well, thank you. I'm also honored to be here.
Chuck, you and Art Campbell have done some great work on the St. Augustine planes and the UFO crash. How did you get together with Art?
And Mr. Campbell was at the Aztec Symposium in 2004 and had parts and pieces of the craft that crashed on the plains of San Augustine July the 2nd, 1947. And as soon as Mr. Campbell stepped off stage, I shook hands. We went for lunch. Before it was over with, Mr. Campbell invited my wife and I and my brother and another engineer, and then I hired four Navajos. We went down to this crash site in the spring of 04 and dug up parts of that craft. We went back in 05 and dug up more parts. Yes, sir.
Now, last year you were telling me you had turned that over to somebody to examine?
It's in, these parts and pieces are in laboratories around the world. I don't know just where all they are.
And have you had any reports yet?
I have over the phone reports. I have yet to get anything in writing. But one of the things that I'd like to announce here today, and I was hoping to have the written report this young man is a student in a college, and what he did, well, first off, the other laboratories have been looking down on the inside of the metal, and this metal is looks basically like aluminum foil, but it's very, very thin, all the way from thinner than a piece of paper to twice or three times as thick as a piece of paper. What he did, he analyzed the aluminum. And I've been told all these years there's only one major isotope of aluminum. It turns out there are two major isotopes. But one of them, and I'm going to call it 27 because I don't have the written report, but I'm going to call it isotope number 27 of aluminum. All aluminum, basically, in the United States and the world is 27. Whenever this gentleman analyzed the isotope of the aluminum that we gave him off this UFO, it's 26. It's almost totally 26. There's no way in God's earth that piece of metal could be made on this earth. We don't have the isotopes. It's here, but in very, very, very small quantities.
So you know in your heart that you have smoking guns. So
I have absolutely know it. And then I also have over the phone isotopes of the nanosize particles down, way down there. They've analyzed them now, and the isotopes of those nano different substances down there, not even close to what we have here on this earth.
So it's not of this world at all.
There's no way it could be, sir.
Now, tell us a little bit about this crash at St. Augustine. We always talk about Roswell. Was this connected?
I think it was very, very connected, but it was 2 days before Roswell.
Right.
This was very specifically on the second day of July. And why I can say that, as Mr. Barney Barnett was one of the witnesses to this craft being crashed, and he was out there on the plane to St. Augustine on the 2nd of July, and his wife, Ruth, made a diary entry of every day of their marriage. And she had him on the plane on the 2nd. And also, there was a group of archaeologists there. We now know as Dr. Dick from Pennsylvania. Mr. Campbell has come up with letters where Mr. Dick was applying for and received the grant to come to the Bat Cave, New Mexico, on the plains of St. Augustine. And he got the grant. He was there. We've got letters saying that he was there July 1947. So we know who it was and when he was there. These other guys, researchers say that he could have been over at Roswell and all that. Well, that's baloney. He is Dr. Dick at Bat Cave.
Now, where is this? And for people in my mind, you live in Gallup. Where is the St. Augustine?
St. Augustine is west of Socorro, and Socorro is about 100 miles south of Albuquerque, and it's also more than 100 miles west of Roswell. Roswell's on the east part of the state. The plains of St. Augustine is on the west side, and it's a vast area surrounded by very, very high mountains. In fact, the dry lakes there are about 1,200 square miles of the dry lakes out there. It's a vast area.
And you've shown me some of the pieces of metal you found in previous interviews.
Yes, sir. I'm holding these, I'm holding seven pieces of metal plus a piece of plastic in my hand as we speak.
Now, when we talk about this, you found this over a period of time, right? Or was it one dig?
I personally have got items from 2 years.
Okay.
Mr. Campbell has for several years.
Okay. And Art's done some great work on this and also what's happened at Kirkland and a few other things. New Mexico is just full of the stuff that was happening, especially back in those times.
Well, let's go back into those times.
Okay.
Mostly, what people hear about is what they call the Roswell incident. Mm-hmm. And that was a debris field up by Corona, about 80 miles northwest of Roswell, which happens to be about 30 miles southeast of Corona. Corona is my hometown. I was born and raised there. And whenever Mac Brazel found this craft, or the pieces thereof, on the Foster Ranch, Mac was the foreman out there on the ranch, whenever Mac found this debris out there, he came to Corona and tried to get my father to go out to see this the debris. Dad didn't go, but I've heard Dad speak about it many times over the many years. He had, Dad owned the bar there at Corona, and he always stayed at the end. I wished I'd went with Mac, and I wished he had it too.
So he knew Mac Brazel?
Very well.
And but he didn't go. That's too bad.
Yeah, that's really it. Yes. But also in the book that Stanton Friedman did a lot of work on called The Roswell Incident, there's a picture of Bill Brazel in that book. And Bill is Mac's son. And Mac left the ranch shortly after this incident, and Bill took over as foreman of the Foster Ranch. And over time, Bill Brazel found parts and pieces of this craft, put it in a shoebox, or a cigar box, I think it was, and he brought it to Corona and was showing some pieces around, pieces at the bar there in Corona, which was my dad's bar.
Right.
And then a few days later, here came the military and took those pieces. But whenever I read that caption under Bill's picture in the book, the Roswell incident, about 1981, I called up Bill. At that time, he was living in Capitan, and I know Bill most of my life. And I discussed with him a lot. Well, he wanted to know how my mother was because my dad had just passed away. So then I read the caption under that picture where he said he had parts and pieces in the bar there at Corona, and asking point blank, Bill, is this true? And he said, yes. I have absolutely been on a quest since 1981 or two to find out what happened. Jerry, I know a lot, but I certainly don't know it all. But I am putting these pieces together.
I know that's one reason we always grab you and get you on the air when we see you, because it's a mission with you, I think.
It definitely is, because I want to know, because we are being lied to, disinformed, you name it, and they got it covered up. I want to have this out.
You told me that you thought the reason, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you thought the reason all these UFO crashes crashed in that time period, because we knew we zapped them with radar.
I feel confident we did that. Whenever they were
used it as a weapon.
It was designed as a weapon.
Oh, really?
Designed. What it was, whenever they put in Los Alamos back in the early 40s, they put in these huge radar systems there. There were three of them. One is at El Vado up by Taos, which we're kind of close to. One at Moriarty and one over by Continental Divide by Gallup. And these radar systems was to guard the skies over Los Alamos, not just take pictures or see their imprint. They were designed to fry the plane and bring them down. What it did, they didn't know at that time, I predict, that they would be using it, that same technique to bring down the UFOs.
Saucers, because all of a sudden they started showing up.
Yeah, well, this is only a couple weeks after Kenneth Arnold there in Washington. And that made national news. I've got probably 100 or 150 clippings prior to this in local New Mexico newspapers. But that was not national. Kenneth Arnold made national. So somebody somewhere, maybe as high as the president, said, let's bring one down and look it over. So they took this very large radar site from Moriarty. It was a mobile unit. And took it over to the plains of San Augustine and shot one down and triangulated with other small radars. The military went in with cranes and flatbed trucks and picked it up and took it away.
You have any idea, is anybody, there's not many people out there, so it's hard to find the witnesses, but anybody have an idea? I mean, this craft, how big it could have been?
Once again, back to my UFO Film Festival, the sixth annual last year, Mr. Gerald Anderson was our speaker. And for those that don't know, Gerald Anderson was a five-year-old boy back in 1947, and he was an eyewitness to this craft being there on the side of that hill crashed. He witnessed one live alien, dead aliens, and he also witnessed whenever the military came in and rounded up the civilians. The archaeologist, Professor Dick, was there. Barney Barnett was there. And the Anderson family from Albuquerque, they were there. And the military came in a vehicle, MPs, loaded guns, very belligerent, rounded them up, took them out to the road. And Gerald made a very good point. These guys come in off from the highway out to this where it was. He said that the craft was right there. The military did not even ask what was that. They had no interest in a UFO crashed right there. They were interested in the civilians. If that would have been a military or any kind of civilian aircraft, they would have been in with a stretcher and an ambulance. They were not. They were in with MPs and guns.
Now, you said he saw a live ET?
Yes, sir.
Was it injured?
Yes. Well, not so much injured. The other was dead, but it was nurturing to the dead one. And he said that whenever they first got there, it was kind of, looked timid. But whenever the military came, it was very scared. But also, being a five-year-old kid, which would be roughly the size of that live alien, he thought over years since then that he was actually communicating with that alien telepathically. He kind of feels like he was doing that.
And they took the alien away, and we don't know what happened.
I have no for sure real. But there has been, within the last, well, it was in August, a gentleman came forward that was eyewitness to a live alien that he said came out of one of the Roswell crashes.
Yeah, he's an 80-year-old fellow, and saw it up in Virginia someplace.
I don't know the details. Yeah, it's on my website.
Yeah, he saw it.
But that was pretty neat.
He described it in an interesting way. He said it was in a cage.
Yeah, and I think that's really sad.
Yeah, I do too. And you wonder what the military. So you think, and just say it. They shot the thing down. They have witnesses. They wanted to get them out of there, right?
Yes, definitely.
Is that the story?
That's it. But then to continue, 2 days later, on the evening of the 4th of July, they shot down three UFOs over by Corona or Roswell.
Yeah.
What happened is, whenever they shot up to the sky, there was three in formation there. And we know there had been three there by Mr. Fuford. That was an eyewitness to the three a few days before this. And he was at Roswell a couple years ago. In July, he passed away within a couple months. So I saw Mr. Fuford talk. And he said there were three UFOs went over Roswell Air Base, the Walker Air Force Base, in formation. So whenever they looked up there with this big radar, they for sure got one. And that's the Jim Ragsdale site. And Jim Ragsdale, per affidavit, said that he and his girlfriend physically watched a major, huge flash to the north, which would be correct, out by the Foster Ranch. And the thing came in and crashed. And that evening or night, it was about 11 o'clock at night, they physically went over and looked in it. There's four dead aliens, but they don't had flashlights, so they went back to their pickup. Next morning, they went over there and was gathering up parts and pieces, and here came the military.
Nobody reported it.
No, and not only that, how could they find it? My younger brother and I, with a map made by the Jim Ragsdale Association, we had a map in his daytime. We still had trouble finding it. How did those guys find that thing in the middle of the night? They shot it down and came and got it. But what they didn't know, they had trained all these little radars to triangulate the Jim Ragsdale site on the north slope of the Capitan Mountains. What they didn't know is that crash, one of them crashed there by Corona, is known as a debris field. Also, one of them went north of Roswell at the Walter Hot site, and also Colonel Corso in his book, The Day After Roswell, says that craft was north. So they shot down three. They knew they shot down Jim Ragsdale and came and got it. They didn't even know they shot the other two down. They weren't looking for it. Therefore, Mac Brazel found one, and some other civilians found the other one.
Because when you say they use this radar as a weapon, it's not like aiming it. They just turn it on and it's all over the place.
I don't know that much about radar, but I think you're right.
Yeah, and it just knocked everything out.
And it was huge.
It probably did something to the avionics, and probably originally they used that to keep, during World War II, to keep planes away from Los Alamos.
It was definitely designed to keep them away. Yeah. If they went up there, they were downed.
Mm-hmm.
And these things were huge. There's a very good picture of the, by El Vado, the radar site is still there. And they have in their shack there where they had like four major large generators to put the power to this thing. And they've even got where they've done research on these radars, and the first radars they put in there weren't large enough. So they actually took those out and put in larger ones. And it certainly wasn't for a plane, because almost nobody had planes in those days.
Yeah.
It was to guard the skies over Los Alamos.
So what's going to become of all of this, Chuck? Are we ever going to get anybody officially to recognize anything?
I think things are in the works that's going to be of quality. I really believe it's happening now. And with all this information that's coming in for these different laboratories, and also some very influential people are involved, I think things are going to turn around.
You're doing good work, and you've been at it for a long time. How long?
Well, I knew about it whenever I was 7 years old, and I'll be 71 on this 7th annual UFO Film Festival. So it's been a while.
Well, happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
Let's talk about that film festival date and the location I didn't mention.
Okay, it's going to be in Gallup, New Mexico at the El Moral Theater, and it'll be from 5 in the afternoon till 11 at night. We've got a really nice old theater there that's really in good shape. They've come in there and put new seats, new screens, new sound system. It's a wonderful place to have a film festival. I hope we have more people than we normally do, because it's mainly local people. But I'd really appreciate
it. Well, maybe we can get some other people to come by there.
I think it'd be worth people's time to hear Art Campbell speak.
Art is going to speak about what?
He's going to actually talk about his years of research. And how he got started is he and his wife had been on vacation and just coming through New Mexico, and they had the book, The Roswell Incident.
Mm-hmm.
They knew about the crash at Roswell, and then they read about the one on the plane to San Augustine. Well, heck, let's go look for it. And that turned into, that was many years ago, and he's still at it.
I know Art, and we've done some good shows, and he's done some great work on the Eisenhower visit to Kirkland.
And he's a tremendous, persistent researcher.
Well, you're not bad yourself.
Well, I have given a shot, but there's so much to this. Oh, one other thing that's important to me is whenever Gerald Anderson was looking at that UFO that was on the side of the hill there, there was a nice big crack in the side. And he said what it looked like there was a horse's tail hanging out of it, because he was a five-year-old boy. That's what he recognized, as his horse's tail.
Uh-huh.
It turned out to be a very large container or stream of fiber optics.
Okay, so, I get what you're saying.
So there was all these fiber optics, this whole wad of them. Why would they need, let's say, a couple inches in diameter fiber optics on that craft? Because it's only like 25 feet in diameter. What I think is, every one of these pieces of foil had a piece of fiber optic hooked to it, and they just have thousands and thousands of these pieces of foil. And every one of these had a fiber optic to it, and some way or another, they put the right frequency, right voltage, that thing can power that craft.
So you're saying this... this mystery metal or this the foil that everybody sees might be part of this new energy that's driving these things.
I think it's the propulsion system. I think it's the lighting system. I think that whole craft is ran by that foil with looking at it correctly. And they may be looking at stuff that we haven't even considered, like gravity. What would happen if we found out for sure that gravity... the speed of gravity is 10 billion times faster than the speed of light. We think 148,000 miles an hour is fast. That would be really quick.
Yep.
And also with a magnet, just a plain old magnet, a lodestone, there's about 200 types of energies coming out of that. They've actually studied, the scientists have studied about 100 of these frequencies. They've got names for about 50. What's over there in that area that we haven't even studied? We don't even know what's there. What's going to happen there? We find that out. Our energy problem is going to be solved.
Some people think we already know the answers, but
I think we're already flying these critters. I really do. And our energy problem can be solved any day that it's decided that we need to solve it. I'm very, very familiar with ways to make energy with no fuel.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that one time.
And I'd like to, on that same subject, in July, Mr. Professor John Searle came to the United States from England.
Came to Albuquerque.
Yeah, he was at Albuquerque. And he is going to put out a Searle effect generator, SEG. And that's going
to
be revolutionary.
Were you able to make it up here to see him?
Yes, I did. In fact,
I talked to him a little bit by phone. Exactly what are we talking about here with his little energy device?
What it is, it looks like a Fram air filter. The round thing with a little distance, about 8 inches high. And around that, there are magnets. And these magnets self-rotate. They self-start and self-rotate and put out energy. And just how it works, I don't know. But that's one of my quests of life is to know.
Well, I mean, he obviously feels that you can power houses and units and everything with very little cost of any.
Per what he said on stage and on DVD, he powered his house for nearly 30 years with one of these. And then the power company decided or found out that he hadn't paid an electric bill in 30 years, so they came and got him. And they put him in jail, and while he's in jail, all of everything he had done went away, his research, everything. So basically he became an outcast for many years, and kind of like recently, people had brought him back into the real world, and Professor Searles wants this on the market. And I'm on his team, and also the lady that is my website designer, my website is chuckwadeufo.com. Kara is on his publicity
team. Yeah, you're talking about Kara.
Kara Faye. Yeah, she's my website designer.
Yeah, we talk to her quite often.
She's a wonderful lady. Wonderful. And she really regrets not being here this weekend. She just can't make it.
Yeah, she's a pretty good little movie maker.
Yeah, and post-production. And but she had a two-hour on-the-record one-on-one with Gerald Anderson. And one of these days, it'll be a cut and pasted and whatever they do to it, and we're going to have a film like no others. Yeah, I was talking to the fellow that owns the Gallup Herald right after I got back, and I had that medal from the first UFO dig, and I showed the owner of Gallup Herald that. He said, let's let people know. Let's have a film festival. And it was just a fluke of luck that we started it, and we're still going.
So he was all for it.
Oh, yeah, and still is.
Well, keep it up, Chuck.
Well, thank you. And it's a real pleasure to see you each place I go, Jerry.
It's
wonderful.
Keep running across each other. But, Chuck Wade, thanks very much for being on. I'm Jerry Pippin, and you've been listening to our broadcast direct from Angel Fire Resort. And, of course, it's in conjunction with the 2010 Paranormal Symposium and Film Festival. And I tell you, it's a good little place to come. If you've never been to Angel Fire, I would recommend it sometime. You don't have to be a skier, but if you are, you're going to find out they got some great slopes here. Roberta Scott's our on-location producer. Jane Swartley is our web producer. Until next time, cheers.